Relief Aid is a humanitarian organisation founded by Kiwi Mike Seawright, and they're currently operating in Syria, delivering aid. And last year was their busiest year to date, providing displaced families with shelter and hygiene kits to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Their winter aid deliveries included warm clothing for children who face freezing conditions in tents. Well, to tell us about the work that Relief Aid is currently engaged in, Mike's with me in the studio. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Karen.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, great to be here, thanks.
Let's talk about Syria to start with. In Syria, you've got a combination of 10 years conflict, dire economic conditions, weak health system, I imagine, and that's compounded by COVID. Citizens there, the ones that are still there, under extreme stress.
The situation in Syria at the moment is absolutely catastrophic. They've seen 10 years of war, being bombed, forced from their homes, and now they're facing COVID, a virus that spread through the world, but now in the displacement camps where hundreds of thousands are living.
So we're talking about North Syria, or the northern part of Syria on the border with Turkey. How many are in those camps?
Well, they estimate there's over 1 million people living in these camps alone, plus a further 3 million living in the northwest province of Idlib. So there's a lot of people there. In fact, the population has increased four times since the war started. So we've got a lot of people squeezed into a very narrow space looking for sanctuary along the border with Turkey, because what Turkey offers when you're close to their border is a no-fly zone. And this is absolutely gold for people that have been forced from their homes by airstrikes from Russian and Syrian forces.
Well, and that's not even counting the 5.6 million people who are displaced, who have left Syria altogether.
Yep.
So those that are left, these are the people that you are trying to help, and you obviously can't help them all, but it's Relief Aid is the organisation you have. So tell us about that.
Well, I've been working in the humanitarian sector now for over 15 years. I was originally in the corporate side of life. Frankly, I enjoyed the money that brought to us, brought to me. I had a big 50-foot yacht, sailed around the Gulf, actually, here in Auckland, so I pretty much enjoyed my lifestyle there. But I had looked forward and saw, let's say, a life of comfort, and with all the creature comforts of toys, for example, boats, and I was looking for a little Porsche at the time. Apparently I need to pay my tax bill, so that didn't actually eventuate. But I sort of looked forward and said, well, okay, well, if I end up on my deathbed, and frankly I hadn't looked forward in my life, I was still relatively young then, what would I have achieved? So this led me to the question, well, would I die rich, or would I die having done something I considered worthwhile? And that led me into the humanitarian sector, and 10 years later we started Relief Aid.
Was it through any religious affiliation, or just one of those moments where, as you said, when I die, I want to have done something meaningful?
Well, I think we're fiercely independent. So we provide aid, provide humanitarian assistance, irrespective of your race, your gender, your religion, your political affiliation. So it absolutely has nothing to do with religion or any other factor that may define you as a group or an individual. What we do is we deliver aid on the basis of need alone. And so we look at communities, and war zones are pretty much at the very acute end of need, and we say, which of these populations need our help? And this was the basis of what I founded Relief Aid on.
I just wondered about you personally, though.
Well, from a personal perspective, I absolutely see the need for us to help those less fortunate than ourselves. We're really lucky to live in New Zealand. I feel privileged still to live here. With all the creature comforts, my children go to a good school. If they get sick, they obviously get looked after. We've got a wide social network, a social welfare system, I should say, that supports those in need. But many countries around the world, they don't have this. And so you can look at the humanitarian sector, and I've worked in very acute places before founding Relief Aid, and less acute places. But I saw right at the forefront that war zones meant that you had no help, no one was accessing you, no one was coming to you because it was a dangerous place to work. So this became a personal driver for me to say, okay, if we need to help people in the world, and I fiercely believe we do, then who should we help? And so we went for the war zone. We specialise in war zone work. And that's very much a reflection of my interest in helping those that no one else can actually access.
Yeah, war zones, that's moving towards danger. That must be something within you that says, I can do this. Well, you know, a courageousness within you. Most people would go, well, I'll do it from a distance.
Well, I think we're surrounded by people that, first of all, know their job very well. So this is not a job for those without experience. You have to gain that experience, and I've been lucky enough to do that through my humanitarian career, learning the skills and experience necessary to operate comparatively safely in these war zones. But yeah, it is dangerous. I mean, we've lost staff in Syria, for example. In 2015, we had two staff killed by snipers. So we had teams at the time running trucks along Castillo Road, arguably the most dangerous road in the world at the time, dodging planes and airstrikes that were coming down, looking for two-hour windows to move the trucks into the city. The city was besieged at this point. And so we were in the middle of this, in between two competing war zone or war groups, with our staff literally getting bombed on a daily basis. And so we, you know, this day unfolded in particular, where I got a call in the morning and we heard this news that our staff had been killed while fixing some communications equipment on the roof, two of them. So I kind of thought, oh my goodness, you know, we accepted risk when we worked in this place. We accepted risk when I founded Relief Aid. Obviously, war zones are dangerous places, but the very worst had been realised, you know, on this particular day. So I kind of went to the team and said, hey guys, this is not business as usual. We can't just continue as though nothing has happened. I want to have a meeting. I want to like sit down and decide whether or not we can actually continue doing our job in this place. So this is what I find absolutely inspiring about doing this job. The team ignored me. They literally just, they didn't answer my messages, yeah? They went to the funeral the next day, and the day after, 2 days after our friends had died, they went back to work. So who are we to say we can't work in these places when our staff are saying we're going to carry on anyway?
How many staff do you have on the ground there?
So we have between 7 and 12 staff inside Syria at any one time. That surges to around 25 in the midst of our heavy distribution periods, and we're about to engage another 28, actually, to run a disease surveillance program in the northwest of Syria, so basically to track COVID.
Are they locals or are they from around the world?
Well, we have national teams inside Syria, so these are the people I've just mentioned. They are there primarily because, one, they're very good at their job. They've got huge experience, in fact, more experience than any international we could probably bring to bear on the situation. But more importantly, they're not such a target for kidnapping, and this is one of the big problems that has happened in northwest Syria specifically, is the kidnapping and unfortunately execution of international aid workers. What this has meant is that we rely heavily on our Syrian staff to deliver the aid. And I have to say, this is another inspiring element of working with these teams. They are incredible. They've had choices to go and work elsewhere, to leave the country, to flee into Turkey and then onwards to Europe. But they haven't. They've just stayed and continue to serve their people.
Gee, and the juxtaposition for you now, here we are in the New Zealand summer. In Syria, it's winter.
Yep.
It's very cold. I'm sure the temperatures drop below zero. And in those camps, even though they look like they're a little better than they used to be, they seem to be from some of the pictures I've looked at, the conditions are just very, very hard, aren't they? There's no running water, for example, is there?
There's no running water, there's no health care, there's no reticulation of any service of all. The camps themselves are surrounded by mud and ice and snow and winter and searing heat in summer. As we talk about winter right now, it's -5 at night, and we're in our summer, enjoying camping, the beautiful sea, the lovely tent conditions, but unfortunately families in Syria don't have any of this. It's freezing cold, and they've got nowhere to go. We enjoy our camping for a month or two over that summer period. Obviously, we're only going to be there for a week at most, generally. But they've got 4, 5, and in some cases, 6 years stuck in these camps, year after year, having to eke an existence out through winter.
And raising children and trying to keep their dignity in those conditions and COVID.
Yeah, well, this is one of the beautiful things about our job. We see the worst in humanity. You know, we see people blowing things up, damaging civilians, hurting people, but we also see the very best that humanity has to offer. We meet families like Amar. She was in her house. She lived on a little farm in the south of the province. A whole region got blown up, bombed, I should say. 14 airstrikes in one day, taking out her neighbour's place. So here she is, putting pillows over her kid's head with her, because she felt this was the only way to protect her family. Now, they fled. They're now in the camps. But Amar's now sitting there with this incredible dignity. We go and talk to her. She's lost everything. She has to keep her kids clean. She's somehow trying to feed them. It's -5. She's figuring out, where can I put my kids at night because it's so cold? And yet she's still holding herself as the matriarch of the family, looking after her family. Now, how would we deal with that situation if that was our family and our personal circumstances? I don't know if we'd have quite the same level of resilience and dignity.
And where's the father? Is he no longer alive?
No longer alive. This has been one of the main problems that women have had. If we look at who we serve in northwest Syria, 80% of them are women and children. So we've got many widows who are living alone without the support and the financial means necessary to look after their kids. So very difficult. But I think, as I see with my own mum when I grew up, you know, women are strong, they are resilient, and they do lead, you know. So are men necessary? Well, they would certainly add to a family like we see in New Zealand, but people like Amar continue to look after their kids with or without their husbands.
In these camps, which you've been to, I imagine you didn't go last year because of the travel situation with COVID, and possibly may not be going. Do you go into the camps themselves, or do you work from the Turkish border?
We, because of the risk of kidnapping for international staff, we base our international teams on the southern border of Turkey.
Right, so how do you see what's going on inside the camps? Do they film for you and show you pictures of what's going on?
Absolutely, and we talk to our team every day. So I'm on the phone, on WhatsApp actually, messaging our team for 3 or 4 hours every single day of the week. So this is, they tell us what's going on, we're documenting all of our interventions through photos, recognising what our team's doing by looking at the pictures and saying, okay guys, I saw that you had that tent up there, maybe we can put it over here while we're distributing. I see you've got the cones laid out to separate individuals, that's a little bit close, so let's make sure we keep that social distancing running. So as best we can, and I would say we've got excellent oversight of our activities, we operate more or less the same as if we were there. I mean, the pandemic has shown us that remote management using remote tools gives us as much certainty as if we were sitting in the same room.
Right. So when you go into a camp, we talked earlier, you can't look after them all, but who do you target, or what do you do? What are the key things that you do when you go into a camp?
Well, this is one of the biggest challenges for our team. They're surrounded by despair and suffering, the people in the camps. Every camp, no matter which one they go to, has high needs. So we're having to choose between one camp over another. And this is very difficult for our team because, of course, they'd like to help everyone. But the reality is that's not possible. We don't have unlimited resources. And while I'm very proud that we've distributed aid to over 200,000 people, this is all on the smell of an oily rag, the fact is we could be doubling that if we had more support. So hard decisions need to be made, and this is hard for the team to make them, because they will still see Amar's family and they'll see Ahmed's family over here, and they have to decide of these two using defined criteria, so we make it clear for them how to choose, but at the end of the day, some families will miss out. And this is not easy.
Very difficult. So let's talk about what you're providing for them and where do these resources come from?
So in a camp setting or in a conflict setting, the basics are what are essential. We're not talking about high-tech equipment here. We're talking about the basics for winter, for example, blankets, mattresses, tarpaulins to cover tents, winter clothing for the kids. So these are simple things to keep families safe. And in the case of COVID, we provide hygiene materials so they can stay clean as well. So this is essential for just staying alive, essentially. Now, we're a tiny little organisation, operate mostly out of my home office here in Grey Lynn, and we've got an office at the university, thanks to them. We're able to extend that into an internship program. But the fact is that more support's required. And so we've gone over, formed partnerships with overseas charities, such as Shelterbox and Medicine Sans Frontier, Doctors Without Borders. They give us the materials, and we're able to distribute it to families in need. And what this allows us to do is we leverage every dollar that we gain in financial support from our supporters, we're able to leverage $10 in material support. So it was a game changer for us, actually. It was the thing that got us from an idea into an operation, into humanitarian action inside Syria, was these partnerships.
And how about you and your own personal circumstances? You've gone from investment banking to humanitarian work. The pay grade's not quite the same, is it?
Well, I don't think there's any way to compare the pay grade of a humanitarian worker and an investment banker, unfortunately. But one of the good things about not paying in a profession is that you get people committed to the cause, not for the money. And I think there's also, if you look at it from a small business perspective, because we are effectively a small business, myself personally, I'm not unique in terms of building a business. How many businesses in New Zealand don't pay themselves for years as they try and gain the traction to sell their product, in inverted commas? So this is what I've done. You know, I'd like to earn some money, but at the end of the day, we won't do that at the cost of our beneficiaries.
Yeah, and what about your children? How many children do you have?
I have a 13-year-old daughter and an 11-year-old daughter. So both of them, my youngest one has just finished primary school, actually. So, yeah, and they're moving on. And, now they want an iPhone. So this is kind of the next question of life, as I think all Kiwis are now struggling with. Our kids grow up and have quite different demands to what we used to have anyway.
That's true. So in regard to talking to your girls about the job that you do, do you tell them what you do? Do they know?
Yes, is the short answer, but I'm careful to take the acute end of life out of it, both in terms of suffering of the people that we serve, but also, let's say, some of the dangers that we face in doing our work. When I was in Yemen, for example, in 2014, every night the building's shaking as they're bombing around us. Syria, the same thing. So, of course, what we don't want to do, what I don't want to do, is scare my kids into thinking that, you know, Dad might not come home. But at the same time, I spend a lot of time trying to explain to them the differences between what we have here and what other families and other kids don't have in the places that we work. And I like to think they kind of see this. They recognise, well, we are actually lucky. I'm not sure it applies every day when they're demanding something new, but, you know, kids will be kids, of course. And hopefully they continue to kind of hold that message into the future as they develop into adults themselves.
Sacrifice the iPhone?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah, probably not.
What about your friends? Do they know what you do? Do you sit around and, I mean, it's the wrong term, but tell a few war stories?
Well, I have been known to, let's say, have a couple of beers and spout some stories off. I think generally the feedback I get from my friends is I've already told those stories and please get a new story. But yeah, they're very supportive.
That's great.
Yeah.
And this year, 2021, are you looking to get back into that area? Is it something that you hope will be able to happen any time?
Well, I think our team continues to work in northwest Syria, irrespective of whether or not we're able to put international staff there or not.
Yes.
So business as usual will carry on, we'll continue to deliver, and frankly, we will continue to need support for us to provide humanitarian assistance to these areas. With regards to my own travel, for example, I'm normally pre-COVID in the Middle East 3 or 4 months a year. So we would expect as the international restrictions ease, that that schedule will go back to, let's say, normal.
And what about New Zealanders listening? Is there anything that they can do to support this?
Well, I think we can't do our job without support. I think this is clear. I'm always a little bit hesitant to kind of put the hand out per se. But the reality is, without support, we can't do our job. So, yeah, I mean, visit our website, come and see our work on our Facebook and our social media platforms. If you want to know what we're doing, contact me. I get many calls, actually, seeking further information about what we do, and frankly qualifying us in terms of our credentials and ability to deliver, and making sure we do that in a cost-effective way. And this is one of the key things we hear from donors: how much is your overhead? And ours are virtually zero, actually. We would be by far the least overhead organisation at 1% to 2% in the entire country.
What kind of donors do you have? What sort of people are they, or organisations are they?
Well, there's a combination. We sometimes get support from foundations. We get support from people with money. This is, frankly, a little bit difficult. Lots of people with money, so they get canvassed quite a bit. But probably the donations we certainly appreciate the most are the small ones. And that's not because $10 changes the aid equation for us, but because we recognise that if someone can only give $10, they're actually giving quite a bit of their income. So we consider this pretty important, actually, symbolically. So we'd like those $10 donations, because if we look at numbers themselves, 25 gets a family of six an aid package. So, you know, these things count. And when we started Relief Aid, one person seemed a lot, especially when we had no partners and no money. 200,000 people later, that's because lots of grandmas, mum and dads have given us money to do our job.
And where can people donate? Do they go to your website?
Yeah, visit our website, www.reliefaid.org.nz. Click on Donate Now and you'll be passed through to a portal. And if you want us to talk to you or talk to your friends, because we like talking about our work, it's not just about money, and it's not even just about delivering aid. It's about being a voice for families who no one else is talking about. So out of sight is out of mind. And what Syrians feel is they have been forgotten. So this is one reason I come on your show, Karen, is to say, okay, well, everyone remember these families that are living in camps, because they feel they've been forgotten.
Do you get to hear from any of them? I guess it's difficult for them to communicate with you. The facilities would be nil.
Well, we're lucky because we talk so often to our team, so we're talking to our team every day, and yes, they share their conversations with the people that we serve. And in addition, we actually go out actively and talk to them. So this is where Amar, the conversation with Amar, came about. She was one of the ladies, one of the woman families that we had served. So we go and ask her lots of questions. Tell us about your life. How did you get here? What barriers and challenges did you encounter coming here? And what are your aspirations for the future? So like anything, having conversation is as simple as asking the questions, and we're very lucky to have the access to these places to allow us to have those conversations.
So you really must get to know the kids themselves.
Well, we do get to know the kids, but we also get to know their parents. I was in Yemen in 2014, and lots of homes were being bombed, actually, by Saudi forces, as it was at the time. And one of the little kids came in to our emergency room quite burnt, actually, not seriously damaged, actually, but just superficial burns across his body. And we got chatting to him. I got chatting to him. He's just a little three-year-old. And I was asking, through an interpreter, because I don't speak Arabic, well, certainly not very well, and I was asking the father what had happened. And this made me, as a father, it really clenched my gut, you know, like in a beautiful sense. The airstrikes had come in order to protect their son, they'd dived on top of him. So the building had caved in on all of them, but the father, at complete risk to his own life, had thought of nothing other than protecting his son. And so the reason little Ahmed, his name was Ahmed actually, was alive was because his dad was on top of him. And, you know, on a nice note, as opposed to seeing the really dark side of life, both father and son were alive. So they managed to get through that together, and Amar can owe his life to his father, who, potentially sacrificed everything. I have to say, it's not to put too dark a moment on it, but it's one of the highlights of my life and one of the absolute travesties of my humanitarian life is one of the children we supported was a girl called Miriam. So this was in 2015. We'd done distributing winter jackets, little red ones actually. And our team, so we got to know this girl quite well. And a few weeks later, our team sent me a photo of her, and she had been hit in an airstrike on the road. So she was quite broken. Yeah. So the connection in our initial meeting with her was beautiful. And of course, what this and it still haunts me today, to be honest. This photo, seeing her as I would perceive my own children to be, frankly, was devastating.
Did she live?
No, she was well beyond this when we found her.
That's very sad.
Yeah, I think it brought home to me why we do our work. She may not have survived, but at least she was warm up until that point. And so I sort of view this on as a sort of personal driver as to why we do our work, because of little girls like Miriam.
And that human connection.
If we're only human when we talk to others, and we're lucky enough to talk to some amazing kids and mothers who have seen things that we'll never experience in our lives.
Gee, well, thank you very much, Mike, for coming in and telling us all about your work in Syria, and all the best for 2021.
Thanks a lot.
That's Mike Seawright from Relief Aid.